This is Dylan FM, the podcast that goes deep into the work and world of Bob Dylan. You're listening to an extended episode, available exclusively to FM Plus or premium subscribers, with your host, Craig Danieloff.
What do Frank Zappa, Elvis Costello, Laurie Anderson, Martin Mull, and Thelonious Monk have in common? The following quote has been attributed to each of them. Writing about music is like dancing to architecture. If you want to know who really said it, check the show notes. But this confusion about the quote may have distracted from a bigger problem, which is that it's just plain wrong. When writing about music is done well, it's fantastic and effective. We've had at least five authors talk about their books on Dylan FM so far, each sharing elements of their books with us, all because they fit the context of our focus, mostly last year's season one look at Time Out of Mind. But I don't want to limit us anymore to just talking to authors whose works align with our seasonal focus. So in this episode, we're going to start a new occasional series in which we'll talk to authors about cool Dylan books just because they're cool Dylan books. Today, we're going to talk about a brand new book called Bob Dylan in Minnesota. It's the third in a series. The first was Bob Dylan in London, and then came Bob Dylan in the Big Apple. And our guest today is the co-author of each of these books and the guiding hand behind the series. Keith Miles is a longtime Dylan fan. He attended the Isle of Wight Festival in 1969 as a very small child, I'm sure. And today, he's the co-curator of the Dylan Room in London's Troubadour Club. His co-authors on this Minnesota book include a bunch of great Dylan writers and fans, such as Paul Metza, Ed Newman, Mark Perkansky, and Matt Steichen. Plus, there are contributions from Linda Whiteside and Kevin Odegaard. A lot of Dylan books, like a lot of Dylan songs, are serious, lengthy, and a bit intense. They demand attention, concentration, and some focus to really get the most out of them. But as we all know, there are Dylan songs that are just simple, good fun. The kind you can take in and enjoy without breaking a sweat. And that's more the style of the Dylan In series. They're not the slimmest Dylan books. The new one is 42 chapters. But they're light and easy reading, and the chapters are sometimes just a few pages long. You can get through them in one or two sittings easily if you want to. But it's their focus that makes them unique. Each of the locations that they've chosen so far have been a big part of Dylan's life over the past 60 or even 80 years. And by focusing on the events and people that took place in these locations, it turns out to be a really nice way to tell the story. These would be great books for any young or new Dylan fans, but as someone who has plowed through many of the fatter volumes, I still learned a few things and really enjoyed reading each of them. Keith joins me today and we talk about this new Minnesota book, which you can get via Amazon or at other bookstores now. I'll include links to all of them in the show notes, as well as Keith's other volume on Bob Dylan and Dylan Thomas. Check the show notes. But for now, here's our chat with Keith Miles about Bob Dylan in Minnesota. All right, Keith Miles, welcome. Thanks for joining us to talk about your new book, Bob Dylan in Minnesota.
Thank you. Thank you, Craig. Thank you for having me on the show.
Well, third in a series, so you're rapidly rising up the list of prolific Bob Dylan authors. You did a really nice book of Bob Dylan in London, which I really enjoyed. And then a few years ago now, I think, and we can talk about these a little bit, you did New York. And this is the third stop. We're in Minnesota. I guess, you know, a little backdrop on your Dylan fandom and how you came to become a Dylan author taking us on this world tour.
Sure, yeah. I mean, it's actually more than that and quicker than that, in fact, because I got to the age of 61 without writing any books whatsoever. And 2 years later, I've written four books and had them published. So it's been an incredibly rapid 2 years, yeah. I mean, I've been knocking them out, as they say. And it was one of those strange things, you know, we went into the sort of pandemic over here, and I had put together a lot of stuff with a friend of mine, Jackie Lees, on Bob Dylan in London. And through the joys of Twitter, of all things, we got approached by publishers who said, this looks really interesting stuff. Would you like to do it in a proper book? And it was fabulous. It was great. And Jackie and I did the Bob Dylan in London book. And it really was, there were certain things we wanted to do. You know, number one, we were Londoners and Bob Dylan fans. So we wanted to put the record straight on the trips and the pubs he'd been to, and interview the right people and do the research properly, which hadn't been done. You know, the hundreds and hundreds of Bob Dylan books, you know, had a lot of the pubs wrong, and in the 62 visit and things like that, that we just felt passionately we wanted to put right. And also for people to visit the places. You know, it's a joy that as a main centre of popular music, London has fantastic places for tourists, Dylan and otherwise, and they're kind of ignored. And, you know, we had taken over and started to run the Dylan Room at the Troubadour Club in London. And if we could stop tourists going to Oxford Street and go to places like that instead, then we're doing a good job. So it was always intended to be a guidebook, you know, which is why it's a paperback. It's, you can put it in your pocket. It is one you can read and enjoy the stories, but also you can use as a guide as well. And the other thing we wanted to do was, you know, I sitting in a room next to a library of literally hundreds of Bob Dylan books, you know, I can't stop collecting the darn things. And not a lot of them are a great deal of fun. And, you know, I think Bob Dylan is a great deal of fun. And I think that, you know, the people around him and the characters and the people are rich, is a rich tapestry of musicians and fun people. And, you know, someone like Bob Dylan, you know, does live life to the full. And I think that Dylan books had become a little bit bogged down and were getting a bit too worthy and a bit too serious about everything. And I think, you know, we wanted to inject some great tale, you know, tell people some great stories about Bob Dylan and his, you know, and his world, you know, and that's what we did. And, you know, wonderfully, the book was well received. And from having never considered doing this, you know, we suddenly had an Amazon number one bestseller in the category. And it was right, okay. And Jackie didn't want to write any more books, you know, that was a process enough for her. But the publishers said, would you write three more? And which is exactly what I've done, completing, you know, we then say in the middle of the pandemic, they said, well, look, we'd like you to do one about New York, because that's the sensible next stop, really, and an important one to have a guide. And being in the pandemic, I couldn't go to New York. So I had to have good researchers out there, which was fabulous. And people like Anne Margaret Daniel and others who are, they're the people that know. You know, I know London, I'm a Londoner, but, you know, I don't know New York, and these people do, you know, and really the Big Apple book that came out is kind of down to those people, really, who really do know their stuff. But, you know, but there were certain things I wanted to do with the second book, with the Big Apple book, one of which was interview AJ Weberman. And that was interesting. You know, I thought, how do you find this guy, you know, and someone just gave me his number and said, just ring him up and you can chat to him. And he had to go in the book, you know, he's the pantomime villain in lots of ways, you know, and he's as crazy as a bag of spanners. But, you know, I did really enjoy the honesty of the guy. And, you know, I think he's like that ultimate fan that goes just that one step or two too far with everything, you know. And you know, he was honest about that, and he, you know, I said to him, you know, do you know what kind of regrets do you have? And you know, he did say, you know, I shouldn't have knocked on the family's door and done all these things, and you know, but it was great, and these were wonderful, wonderful, say interesting stories to put in there. And the new book is the third of the guide trilogy. So the Minnesota book is the third that's actually usable as a guide with maps. But the third book that I did was a slightly different approach, which was a book that I wanted to put together, which was the two Dylans, Bob Dylan and Dylan Thomas. It's, you know, it's not a guide as such, so it doesn't fit in with the Troubadour Tales trilogy in the same sort of way. But, you know, essentially it was a little personal side project. I find them both the same kind of rare ilk, which is, you know, again, you look at the phrase troubadour, I mean, but they are very much, you know, not my phrase. They're doing form literature. You know, it's a different thing. What Bob Dylan does, he doesn't sing poetry. He's doing something else. You know, I say, you know, I think it's encapsulated in that term, not my term, but form literature, I think, is what he and Dylan Thomas were doing. And so we come round to the Minnesota book and the last of the four books.
Great. I really enjoyed the London book. I thought what you said today was correct, that you really did in that one dive down to a lot of details about something that was actually kind of old and most people glaze over it, let's just say. And so I really, what I liked about that one was filling in all the specifics about it. Although, as you say, the other interesting thing about your books, and especially in the new one, I thought that was true. It's kind of, it's a little breezy in a nice way. Whereas, as you say, other books, other Dylan books are like a commitment. You know, you got to kind of work. They're rewarding, but they're not quick and fun. And this one, you know, you can just kind of get through pretty quickly, overview of a lot of stuff, in this case from a bunch of different voices. So that's nice.
I think breezy is good. I like breezy. That's fine. I think one of the nicest reviews for the books said that the books were refreshingly non-academic. And again, you know, I'll take that. You know, I mean, you know, there are a lot of books, and I mean a lot of books that, you know, you get to the end of the sentence and you cannot remember how it started. That's for other people to write. That's not me.
And it's great that you've, with New York and with Minnesota now, pulled in the locals, the people who, as you say, have a lifetime of experience. And in this case, you know, you got some people who are involved over time. That's a smart way to make sure that the books are, you know, accurate and thorough by bringing in, you know, Anne, you know, absolutely, who knows New York super well. And you've got a big cast of characters on this one.
Yeah, no, I mean, it was really important. I looked at, for the third one in the trilogy, there were various options that I looked at and I wanted to do. I was quite keen on doing a book about Japan, because I think Japan and the market there for music is very different. And Bob Dylan is very important to the Japanese music scene, you know, possibly more important than in many other places. And I looked at that, but the difficulty there is, you know, I think you just have to live in Japan for a while, you know. So, you know, Minnesota is the obvious place. I mean, I was lucky enough to be invited to the first conference out in Tulsa, and I gave a talk, obviously, from an English London perspective about Bob Dylan and Robert Gray, which was fabulous and is a big passion of mine and a big part of the London book. But, you know, as you'll have seen in the front of the Minnesota book, one of the things that really struck me, and this is no criticism of the job that people have done in Tulsa. I think they've done a fabulous job altogether. Clearly what is now a wonderful center and a wonderful archive and a wonderful experience for people. And that you know, there's absolutely no criticism of that at all. But you just think, this should be in Minnesota. This is kind of really, you know, Tulsa, lovely, lovely. And I had the time of my life there. But boy, this should be in Minnesota. You know, and to me, it was so important to get this right. You know, I said to the publishers, look, you know, I can't do this on my own. I've got to bring in, you know, a huge squad of Minnesota legends for this one. You know, I've got to, A, get it absolutely spot on correct. But B, I could have moved to Minnesota for 10 years and written a book. You know, that's one way I could have done it. Or I could have got these bunch on board. And, you know, I have to say they've been a fabulous, fabulous bunch of guys to work with. I mean, really lovely, you know, so steeped in the world of Bob Dylan there, you know, either individually or in the case of Matt Steich and the whole family, you know, they're the first Bob family of Minnesota. You know, these are people that know their stuff and live and breathe the legacy of Bob Dylan there. And it was massively important to get a cast of the right people together on this. You know,
let's mention you have Paul Metza, Ed Newman, Mark Prakansky, Matt Steichen, as you mentioned. There's a few others. Linda Whiteside.
Yeah. I mean, there's a few others that crop up in the book. I mean, it's you know, my name is on the front, as with the Troubadour Tales, but it's like, you know, I'm just
Kevin Osegard wrote a thing.
Yeah, right. Kevin Osegard. Yeah, no, it's big time Minnesota people. Really, it is absolutely their book. You know, I'm the strange Englishman that's decided to pull this whole thing together. And you know, I mean, I might be totally wrong on this. I get the kind of impression, and this may be to an extent why we've ended up with this odd situation where you've got the Bob Dylan archive and the center of everything based in Tulsa. You know, clearly, obviously, it was, you know, guided there. yeah, that's what I was getting at. But, you know, which is fine. That makes the world go around, apparently, according to the song. You know, I get the impression that over the years, there's been this, you know, at times, as I think with every kind of homelands of any big star or writer of anything, there's a little bit, well, you know, there's other things here. That's not the only thing that's happened here, you know, and stuff like that. Right. And I think you've also had, I think, a sort of, I don't know if it's healthy or unhealthy or whatever, but a certain competition between Duluth and Hibbing for the center of it. And I think this is my view, and hopefully in some small way this book can help that process. I think now Minnesota is coming together that includes those three key parts, you know, because it's, you know, Bob Dylan is not just Duluth, he's not just Hibbing, he's not just Dinky Town, you know, these are all, you know, huge parts of his story and the first critical phases of his story. And, you know, I think it's Minnesota. I think that's it. And I think maybe the time has come for it to be seen as Bob Dylan in Minnesota, as opposed to various other places where things happened in that particular time. And, you know, you know, maybe there will be an alternative Tulsa will grow out of this to an extent.
I think Tulsa should be in Manhattan, so we're going to need three wings if we're going to do it that way. But
oh, I'd love that. I mean, but the when I did the Big Apple book as well, I just thought, well, I think I the impression I got was Greenwich Village isn't enough of how Greenwich Village was. to hold a center. I mean, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe it would be great to have, you know, a Bob Dylan center in New York. I mean, maybe have him everywhere, you know, but we franchise it out, you know.
yeah, well, different topic, but there are, you know, he's a big presence in a lot of places, and that, you know, has given you a good book series. I think also, I mean, it's interesting what you said about them being not wanting to be overwhelmed by the legacy. I also think there's been a little bit of a, you know, a taste of resentment that he didn't, you know, although he's still, as you show in the book, you know, has connections there and maintained them over the years. You know, he distanced himself, so I think there was a little bit of them not wanting to be chasing. And, you know, some people, I was talking to someone the other day, and I'm not remembering right now who thought it was one of the nice things about Hibbing is that it's not like Bob Dylan Disneyland. It's got a little, there's a little more notice there now than there was. I went about almost 20 years ago to Hibbing, and, you know, got to walk around the high school and go to the house and stuff. But before there was a street name, and I went to the library basement, which, you know, there's a little thing there, and Zimmy's was still open when I went. But it's nice that it's not, you know, over the top, which, you know, in America, at least, if we go too big and, you know, everything becomes Dollywood or some kind of cartoon joke, and people like that Minnesota is calmer than that.
Yeah. I'm not sure what sort of place Bob World would be. Yeah, but I get what you mean. But I think it seems to me, and I've only picked this up from talking from the Minnesota guys and from the research we put in, it seemed to me there was a certain amount of kind of resentment that, you know, I mean, he does keep going back, and he has gone back through the years plenty of times, you know, but it, you know, they kind of didn't see it as enough. And that, you know, I mean, he's not, you know, he doesn't live there, you know, and he's not, you know,
he's not a guy prone to satisfying people.
Yeah. Being Bob Dylan must be a crazy thing at the best of times, but, you know, everyone wants a piece of all of this, and, you know, and I don't think he could ever please the people back there, you know. However many times he came back, and he would, you know, he would come back and he would buy up businesses for times, and he would perform there enough times. I think the kind of resentment was a bit misplaced, if I'm honest. And I think some of it seemed to be still this Duluth versus Hibbing, where which one is he from? You know? And the reality is from both, you know. And more importantly, he's from Minnesota, you know, and this is the big sort of homeland sort of
part. I think they did embrace Prince more than Bob, which is interesting.
Yeah, and I mean,
we don't have to go on about it, but it's an interesting dynamic. Yeah. since you just looked at it, let's look at a little bit. The book has a lot. What is it? 40 chapters, 42 chapters. You cover a lot of ground. You start with the early days, about the houses, about the family journey, the bar mitzvah story. That was interesting. The tracking down of the original traveling rabbi.
Yeah, I mean, that must have been a heck of a strange thing, you know, with the almost mythical rabbi that came out of the snowy mists and then disappeared as swiftly as he'd arrived. It was I think even what Bob Dylan said about this, he sees it as an odd, strange time, but he tried to, as everyone did, sort of change his persona as soon as he got to Greenwich Village. But he had a good full childhood, and his life growing up was pretty interesting and in relative terms pretty normal and sound. But there you go, the rabbi that came and went must have been a strange thing to a young lad at that time.
Yeah, I don't think that's that unusual in many parts of the United States, because there wasn't rabbis for people, you know, that some of the, in some places where the Jews weren't dense. I've heard of other places where they bring one in or something, but to be Bob Dylan's rabbi, as you say, from Brooklyn and how he got there and how he was a mystery for so long. It's a great story. And it's really a good example of you giving the flavor of one out of many interesting things that happened there and then moving on to something else.
Yeah. And also I think it's one of those things where I personally enjoyed the sort of fairly concentrated research on the background to the two brothers, the rabbi and his brother and where they came from and all that sort of side. But, you know, one of the things I found in the books that we put together in the Troubadour Tales is some of these things are just, you know, for example, in the London book, the first one, you know, when Bob Dylan meets Robert Graves, in Chronicles, he talks about going around a London square and, you know, in typical fashion, it's not the right name. You know, and the research was just essentially going to where the party was at Earl's Court and looking, and no one had been to find where this square was or what it was called. Just actually bothering to go there was the research, you know, and that's, I like to think that in each of the Troubadour Tales book, you know, at least every other page, there's a crikey, I didn't know that story that crops up, you know, even for Bob Dylan fan, you know, and I am essentially still a very much just a fan, you know, and will remain so. But it's interesting. We like to think that in all of the Troubadour Tales, there's enough for the novice and the vaguely interested in the music, but also enough in there for a decent level fan, you know.
Yeah, no, as a hardcore, I enjoyed him a lot. The Orpheum Theater story, for example, you know, I knew he owned it. You know, the time frames might have been vague to me. I didn't know that, you know, David worked there and the kids spent time there. And it's that kind of insider flavor of reality, little tidbits that I think are very nice. And the motorcycle accident, that I had heard of that, I think, but didn't know as much about it and forgot. So the second motorcycle accident in Minnesota, or, you know, the train incident, that was
It was one of those, wonderful things. It's Matt, really. I mean, you know, he knows his stuff, and, you know, we were talking about things that should go in the book, essentially. And it was a throwaway line. Well, you know, and maybe something about the day Bob was nearly hit by a train. Well, what's that? Well, that's got to go in. Well, whatever that is, that's got to go in. And it, you know, it was, fabulous learning from people who've known these stories for many years, you know, and the four guys, like I say, you know, I mean, to me, absolute Minnesota legends in their different fields, but also, you know, know so much of this information that we've distilled down to get the tales across. But interesting you say about David, he kind of crops up in this story every so often, like with the Blood on the Tracks band and things like that. And you just think he's a little unsung hero in the Bob Dylan story, but certainly as part of the Minnesota link, you know, clearly he does crop up, you know, throughout the years on all of this. He's managed either deliberately or accidentally to steer Bob into some great things. A little bit more kudos to David for what he's done for the family, really.
Yeah, I also enjoyed the bit about the time he spent on the farm, you know, in the mid 70s when the Blood on the Tracks writing time, where again there's a little more color in there than, you know, I've heard about, you know, his mom coming by and the kids spending time and all of that, and a lot of the re-mentioning of the friends that he maintained over the years. You know, talk about the difficulty of being Bob Dylan. You know, one of the ways he seems to have dealt with it is to keep a pretty nice cadre of friends that were from the before times, that he, even in the midst of his crazy life and travels and being who he was, you know, he maintained that set of friendships, and they all appear in the book as well.
Yeah. I mean, I think you're absolutely right. And it is interesting that the people seem to be I mean, obviously, you know, in this case, it's family as well. But people do seem to be very loyal to Bob Dylan. You know, the guy is, I mean, he's no saint, you know, and I'm sure he's a really difficult person to, you know, I mean, interviewing Scarlett Rivera for the New York book, you know, one of the things that came through is that, you know, her, bless her, wonderful, wonderful human being and great artist, but, you know, essentially her career just went stratospheric, really, over a short period of time with Desire and the Rolling Thunder Review, and then it gone again, and it's kind of, you know, and other people like I so wanted to put in a chapter in that book about, you know, the Letterman show and the Plugs. You know, again, these were all bunches of people who spent time having worked with Bob Dylan and hit the heights of their career, but then spent time waiting by the telephone for a call that never came. But still love the guy and still, you know, feel a great affection and loyalty towards him, you know, and this is something he cultivated from sort of Dinky Town, Greenwich Village onwards. Everyone wants to kind of look after him and, you know, and retain a sort of loyalty and a fondness towards him, however awful he is at times, or you know, or however, you know, in conventional terms, he lets people down or whatever. They're still there. I suppose the biggest example is Joan Baez. I mean, you know, you would support him to the ends of the earth, you know, despite him being pretty bad towards her at various stages, you know, career and personal and otherwise. But like you say, he manages to you know, to have this great charm that promotes great loyalty in people. And that's, you know, plus he's Bob Dylan. Come on, he's like, you know, there's no artist like him. Of course you're going to be loyal to him.
You know. We hear the cartoon version of the stories, and the things that happen get twisted out of proportion, you know, a little bit. And he's clearly been imperfect in, you know, lots of ways. But I think often the details are a little bit different. But I do think your core point is right, which is if he was really a bad guy, you know, he wouldn't have, first of all, the stories wouldn't be what they are. And they're remarkably consistent of how deeply people who got to interact with him enjoyed it, how, you know, how nice he was. You know, I mean, there's going to be macro or micro incidents that are different, but I think it does paint a holistic story that's different kind of than the expectation. And then, as you said before, you got to put it in the context of it's not easy being him either, and that doesn't excuse certain things, but it also, you can't ignore it. You know, there's nothing in his life that's like any of our others. And the amount of, you know, like the big thing that comes up all the time is this, how he treats people after some time period. He shows up in town and a good old friend can't get backstage. Well, that sounds one way to us, right? Because, you know, we probably have, you know, 50 or 100 people, you know, and if we came to any one town, there might be 3 or 5. But I can't imagine, Bob Dylan comes to New York City, there might be 10,000 people who go to the Beacon and want a backstage pass because they used to do something with him. So
yeah,
a lot of them are going to get a no. And at some point he's going to say, how about nobody? You know, I think you got to put a lot of grains of salt in a lot of the big impressions and the stories, but
certainly professionally, maybe personally, he's always someone who has got to keep moving, got to keep going, you know, and, you know, it's the reason, you know, that the Plugs were never taken on the South American tour, or that there wasn't a Desire to, you know, and things like this. And clearly, I think professionally, and you hear it in some albums where, you know, he hasn't finished it. It's not, you know, like the Blood on the Tracks sort of story in there is, you know, clearly David sort of steps in because it's not quite right, and he can have a go at sort of trying to do this, but you know, it seems that in Bob Dylan's mind, I've moved on. I'm doing the next thing, really. And I think that's the story of his professional career, is he's never staying still too long, and always trying to sort of move along. It's why we've got so many wonderful different Bob Dylans to listen to. It's why we've got so many wonderful albums and great tours to look back on fondly. But it's why it's also sometimes we've got some very clearly unfinished or unpolished product at time, and now that's rectified by the bootleg series, so you just go back to albums and we just do the other stuff out, which is fabulous for the listener, and I wouldn't have it any other way. And I'll probably, like a lot of Bob Dylan fans, I listen to the bootleg series more than I do the studio album. But it means there's a constantly moving Bob Dylan, really. That hasn't changed. That's from the start, really.
The other thing I wanted to mention is the photos in the book. While there aren't many, they're very well chosen, and I thought they're the interesting kind of things that most people haven't seen. There's a Dinky Town photo of the scholar that I thought was great. The Duluth house. Every time they came up, I was like, oh, that's a photo that, I haven't seen 100 times. I think those are well chosen.
It was good. The process of getting the book out, I had the four Minnesota guys, and they've got access to just so much stuff, clearly. And it's a lot of it is pretty new or relatively unseen before. And that was great. I mean, narrowing it down was the difficult bit. Ed Newman's voracious. He would send you 20 different pictures a day, which is brilliant. But you've got to narrow things down a little bit, because otherwise the book doesn't get in your back pocket to go around as a guide.
The idea of these books as a guide is really great. I wish, when I went to drove through Duluth I didn't go to Duluth. When I drove through Hibbing, I was kind of looking around. I knew of Zimmy's and I knew of, but to have all this would really make a great trip.
Yeah, well, it was important when we started the sort of series. I just kind of think that we don't really, and I say this from London, where, we have one of the richest pop music histories, and we don't make the best of it. And there is no wonderfully great music tourism. You can go to places. You could, for example, if you go up to the Manchester Free Trade Hall, which is now a hotel, there's no great big Judas back. What's going on here? It's kind of everywhere. Do you know, the bizarre thing is the only place that really has embraced that and probably taken it way too far is Liverpool. A few years ago you could go to Liverpool and you wouldn't know where to start with any Beatles stuff or where to look. Mm. Now there's a Beatles museum on every corner, but it's but at least it's there. At least they realize that. And I think it's the same with New York as well. It's where to start to look at.
Yeah, I like it this way. I think it's more fun if the people who have your book or have something in their hand and know can find it. And, in New York, you can go to, the different apartments, or you can go to the Chelsea Hotel, or you can go to, the recording studios are around town and lots of things. And it's kind of funner to arrive there and know you're at the right place and that no one else around you kind of knows. You know what I mean?
I agree. I mean, the best way to do this would be for every town and city with music history to have a Troubadour Tales book to go around.
It sounds like you fulfilled the original agreement for three of these, but it's been successful. So may there be more?
We're going to see how things sort of pan out. It's really difficult to know what the right thing would be. As I say, one that I really wanted to do was Japan. And I started doing the research, but it, you know, again, you know, if I was doing that, I should be there now while he's playing. But I think that it's and one of the reasons I didn't pursue that was I didn't have the same people on the ground as I had with New York and I had with the Minnesota book. You've got to have the absolute people that will be in the know and take you around. I did interview a wonderful folk artist called Sashiko Kananobu, who used to be married to Paul Williams, who wrote the touring books about Bob Dylan. So she had wonderful access when Paul Williams was on tour with Bob Dylan. So they would go around, and she then moved to California. And the wonderful thing is she was part of the Osaka folk scene, which was kind of, they all love Bob Dylan, and Bob Dylan didn't go to Japan until 1978, but he was a major hero there. And this scene built up, and she produced an album, which is called Missouri, which is wonderful, wonderful album. And then she moved to California with Paul Williams, and she had no idea that she was a major star in Japan. And she went back, and it's like, everyone knows my song. It was like a complete shock. And she, they said, you know, she was then persuaded to do some, you know, anniversary concerts for something that she was just pretty much unaware of, really.
Wow.
She was fabulous. But and their neighbor tried to persuade her to take up music again and to do this. And their neighbor was the science fiction writer Philip K. Dick. So yeah, there's plenty of stories in there. I just haven't put it all together yet.
Oh, probably California. It might be a mix of LA and Malibu and San Francisco. There's a nexus of people and events in Bob's life.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, the other one was a vague notion of general sort of European stuff. The kind of tales that I want to research properly and tell, you know, include people like you've probably seen the YouTube video of Swiss Liz in Eindhoven. And you know, I think an interview with Swiss Liz, you know, it needs to be in a book. You know, one of the regrets of the London book is that there was a fan that you may have come across called Lamb Chop. I don't know if he translates, but he was the fan that used to tour around the world following Bob and just shout, "Play what you want, Bob," at every concert, you know. And that was his one heckle. You know, he had a catchphrase heckle, which is great. You know, and legend has it that at one concert, Bob recognized Lamb Chop and said, "And there's Lamb Chop. He's seen more Bob Dylan concerts than I have." So I wanted Lamb Chop to be in the book, but you know, there's so many wonderful wonderful fans and people out there as well. And you know, maybe a book would be about the actual fans themselves. I mean, we run the Dylan Room at the Troubadour, and one of the reasons that Jackie and I set that up was to be for a place for Dylan fans to meet. When Bob Dylan played at the Palladium a few months back, it acted as like a sort of fan zone. So fans came from all over the world and met there. You know, for example, we met I can't remember her name, bless her, but there's a quite an elderly French Bob Dylan fan who tours around with her bag of Bob Dylan paintings and etchings, etc. And she swaps a painting for a spare ticket everywhere she goes. And that's her shtick. That's what she does. And she gets in to most of them by swapping one of her paintings for a spare ticket. But yeah, I mean, maybe the fans' story needs to be properly told. But We shall see. We shall see.
I'm glad you, I didn't realize it was 2 years, but I'm glad you set out and did this enterprise, because they really are, as we said, fun, unique, and interesting for new and old fans alike, set of books. So I think I sped read the London one when I first got it, and I sped read Minnesota Today to get ready for this, and so that it can be done fast, but they're full of good stuff. So congratulations, and thanks for time to do them.
Thank you so much, Craig. Thank you.
Thanks for listening.